How I Met Maharishi by Louis Hartz. I met Arthur Osborne in an internment camp in Bangkok during the Second World War. At first, I had little contact with him because he was very reserved. After some time, however, I approached him. I had a craving to understand and asked him point blank, what is truth? What sticks in my memory is how, sitting beside his bed in a common dormitory, he said, I will tell you one truth. Infinity minus X is a contradiction in terms because by the exclusion of X, the first term ceases to be infinite. You grant that? Yes, I granted that. Well then, he said, think of God as infinity and yourself as X and try to work it out. When I asked for more explanation, he just said, think this over and come tomorrow at this time and tell me what you make of it. I returned to my place in the dormitory, which was only some 8 or 10 steps distant. And suddenly, it flashed upon me that he was right, that you cannot take anything away from the infinite, and that I was not apart from it, only I had not known. The thought made me so happy that I could hardly wait to speak to him the next day. But I did not like to disturb him earlier. From that time onward, he started to instruct me, and after a few weeks, he showed me a photograph of the Maharishi. There was an urgency in his voice as he spoke of him, and he handled the photograph with reverence. I began to understand that there was only one, I, and that it was in me and was everywhere. The Maharishi grew so much in my heart that I felt him nearer to me than my parents or my wife. He lived more vividly in me than any person I had known. After some time, we received permission to write a Red Cross letter to our families, and I used mine to write to the Maharishi and ask him for guidance. Then the war ended and I left the camp. The desire to enjoy life sprang up in me again. I was strongly drawn to the spiritual path, but even more strongly, for the time being, to a worldly life. I wanted to make money, to have power and fine clothes, to be important. In camp, I had eliminated daydreaming as far as possible. When I went to bed at night, I slept straight away. But now, my nights were often filled with planning and scheming. A few years later, when I was in Europe and due to return to Siam on business, I wrote to Osborne, who was living at Thiruvannamalai, to suggest that I should break my journey in India and stay there for a few days. He at once wrote back, arranging to meet me and conduct me there, and invited me to stay at his house. In Madras, we hired a car and drove to Thiruvannamalai. It was an old car, and I felt that I was being slowly roasted in the midday heat. When I let my eyes rest upon the sun-baked scenery or the country folk sheltering under the wayside trees, I saw only the face of the Maharishi looming up before me, nothing else registered. I was terribly scared that the Maharishi would look in my eyes and see into me. I cursed myself for a fool for coming to this desolate place with its heat and discomfort. I don't know what prevented me from turning back. Perhaps I was afraid to show Osborne what a coward I was. The nearer we approached the ashram, the more I shrank from meeting the Maharishi. It was nearly dusk when we arrived and he had already retired. But Osborne went in to see him and asked whether he would see me for a few moments. I entered the hall and saw an elderly man reclining on a couch who gave the impression of great reserve and certain shyness. It was not the severe master or the guru with the burning eyes that I had expected. Osborne explained who I was, and his replies were monosyllabic and sometimes in Tamil. With a slow movement of the head, he turned to me and held my eyes for a moment. His eyes were like empty, bottomless pools, and at the same time, they worked like magic mirrors, because suddenly I felt at peace, as though I had come home after a long journey. I can't recall where I slept that night, but I do remember that before going to bed, I sat and talked with a number of people, Indians and foreigners, at Osborne's place. One of them was a diplomat from some European country stationed in China. He talked about seeing spirits and even conversing with them, and it struck me as funny that anyone should be interested in such things at a place like this. Sitting in the hall the next day, I saw that the Maharishi's smile was tender and gracious. I not only lost my fears, but felt at ease. I had no questions to ask. Before coming, I had prepared a number of questions that had been worrying me to ask the Maharishi, but now I couldn't remember them. My doubts had simply evaporated. Questions seemed unimportant. I felt that there was nothing strange about the Maharishi. He was just a man who was himself, whereas all of us were growing away from ourselves. He was natural. It was we who were not. We call him a saint or sage, but I felt that to be like him is the inheritance of everybody. Only we threw it away. There were a lot of people in the hall, Indians and foreigners, learned professors and simple country people. I reminded the Maharishi about the Red Cross letter I had sent him, and he replied that he wanted me to come, and I had come. There was something childlike about him. He was free and natural and could laugh with the spontaneity that only a child shows. A discussion started in the hall, and they appealed to the Maharishi to say who was right. Someone spoke about unity, and I objected that the word implied two, to be united, and that a better word was oneness. And the Maharishi confirmed this. He said that there is only one, and that one is indivisible. I felt that he meant that the divisions are all unreal. Just as we say rain, ice, water, coffee, washing water, but it is all water. A group of devotees started singing, and I asked the Maharishi what he felt about it. He laughed and replied that it pleased them to sing and made them feel peaceful. Next morning, again, I sat in the hall. There was a yogi with matted hair. The diplomat was there, sitting in concentrated thought. I wondered whether I should imitate him, but I did not feel like meditating. Suddenly, the Maharishi looked at me with great intensity. His eyes took possession of me. I don't know how long it lasted, but I felt at ease and happy. Afterwards, a disciple who had been with him for 20 years told me that this was the silent initiation. I felt that it probably was, but I wanted to make sure. So in the hall that afternoon, I said, "Bhagavan, I want your initiation." And he replied, "You have it already." Footnote: this is the only occasion on which I have ever known the Maharishi given express verbal confirmation of having given initiation to anyone. It will be noted that the request was phrased in such a way that the confirmation could be given without any statement implying duality. Editor's note: knowing myself and feeling anxious about what would happen when I left his presence, I asked for some sort of reassurance from him, and he replied very firmly and decisively, "Even if you let go of Bhagavan, Bhagavan will never let go of you." There was some whispering and exchange of glances when people heard that. The diplomat whispered to a Muslim professor who was sitting beside him, and then the latter asked the Maharishi whether this guarantee applied only to me or to him also. The Maharishi did not look very pleased, but replied briefly, "To all." Nevertheless, I felt that there was something intensely personal in it, that it had been a confirmation of the initiation and a direct personal guarantee of protection. Certain it is that whatever else may have happened, there has been no day since then when his face or his words have not influenced me. Sourced from Mountain Path, April 1964.